So, Mike, hey, let's do some follow-up. How's that sound?
Let's do it.
Okay.
Bootleg listeners will know why that's funny.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. All right. So, first things first, you're creating a reading workshop. How's that going?
It's going pretty well. I've got a few people who have signed up already. So thanks everyone who has signed up. This is the first paid workshop that I have ever done solo. I've done some paid workshops with other people in the past, and I know that I can do a good job with this one, but it is a bit of a mental hurdle to get over. You know, this is not just a free webinar. This is actually a paid workshop. But that being said, I love doing these because you can just sink your teeth into delivering the absolute best presentation you can. Whereas with a free webinar, you give some information at the beginning, but you only have really like 45 minutes before people's attention starts to wane because they don't really know exactly what they signed up for. And then you got to get to the pitch for the thing that you're actually selling. Like, this is just really clean, you know, $49. I'm going to help you get more out of the books that you read. Yeah. So I'm really looking forward to this. I've got a bunch of the slides already made up, and I've got some ideas for new things that I want to build out for this yet. The date is going to be April 19th, by the way.
Okay.
I pushed this back just a little bit because I'm also getting my community off the ground. So I haven't officially announced this yet, but by the time this goes live, there'll probably be a public link that you can sign up for. So I know we're talking about the reading workshop. Let me get back to that in a second, because the community has an interesting pricing model. I'm going to do just yearly, no monthly, but $100 a year for the first 100 paying members.
Okay.
And after, just kind of as a way to thank the early adopters, the people who followed me for a long time. So everyone who signed up on the page that you made me create, yes. as like the waiting list.
Yes.
They get first dibs at those 100 spots. And then after that, it's going to go up probably to $150 a year, and then eventually $200 a year. Because I don't want it to get too big. I want to, again, deliver an insane amount of value to the people that are there. And I feel like if I'm going to do this solo, there's a limit to the number of people that I can really serve well.
Yeah.
Anyways, you can go to the link in the show notes if you want to find out more about that. But that's got like all my book notes, my sketch notes, weekly live co-working calls, ask me anything calls, stuff like that.
And I, Mike would tell me not to do this, but I got early access to help, you know, give a little feedback and take a look at things.
It's
looking good, everybody. It's looking good. So be one of those first 100 if you can.
The thing that took the longest out of that was the onboarding. I created a special onboarding section that has a whole bunch of custom CSS. I'm not sure if you caught that. Like, the like buttons are not like buttons. They say mark is completed.
I didn't see that. No, I didn't see that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, anyways, all that to say, I wanted the first time you enter the community to be just a great experience where if you're not familiar with this at all, it walks you through the whole thing. I spent a lot of time creating a bunch of videos and just styling that so it feels different than all of the other areas, and it feels very linear. Like, you go here, you go here, you go here, you go here. By the end of it, you know exactly what's going on there. But yeah, so that's been the focus, but that's basically done now. That onboarding took me 10 times longer than I thought it was going to, but it's done.
It was worth it. It's good.
Thank you. Yeah, so now the focus is on the reading workshop, and I don't think I've ever been more excited to do a presentation than this one. I love talking about not just books, but like the whole reading process. And it kind of shocks me that more people don't really dig into this. Like, I don't know, maybe I'm just a nerd, but I find the whole process fascinating. And every time I bring up like How to Read a Book Being Influential by Mortimer Adler, I get two kinds of reactions. One, if I'm talking about this stuff online, people are like, oh yeah, I really gotta find out about that. But if I do it in real life, like the people who I see day to day, they're like, why do you need a book like that? Yeah. But also they never picked up a book in the last 6 months. So
yeah, I think the number of, you know, real people online or like that exist out there that actually pick up books as frequently as you and I do. It's not.
All that to say that the small group of people that will be joining for this live workshop, I feel like there is not a group of people on the internet that is more my people.
Yes, yes, those are your people. You're going to make some friends.
Hopefully.
Yeah, that's great. Okay. So, next thing is we launched a pro show and we launched a Patreon, and that's going well. So I just want to thank everybody, for, you know, the folks who signed up, the folks who are considering signing up. Thank you so much. We are excited to do that and we're excited to figure out a way to support the show a little more long term. And, you know, just the update on that is it's going well. So thanks.
Yes, I will echo everything Corey said. Thank you to everybody who supports us via the Patreon. And what we did to keep this kind of simple is we created a couple of feeds. And I'm using a service called Hello Audio for this, but we've got a bootleg feed where basically we hit record on Zoom when we get connected, and then that gets uploaded to the bootleg feed without any edits. So that's why I made the comment about bootleg listeners will know why that's funny when we started the episode, because there was a little bit of a misfire.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes.
So that gets published really, you know, we record these almost 2 weeks before the episode launches. So those get thrown up right away. If you want to get the earliest possible version of the show, that's the one. It's hot off the press. But then there's a pro show, which has a separate segment. Today we talked about apprenticeships, and Corey asked me where I would like to apprentice, and it caught me completely off guard. So
he did a great job,
my answer, thank you. All that Toastmasters training paid off. but yeah, so it has an extra segment, and then when we have ads, those ads will be removed. So that is another separate feed that you can sign up for. And then there's also a Bookworm wallpaper, which is uploaded there. All of that stuff you get instant access to when you sign up for Patreon. We use Patreon because they handle all the merchant record stuff. I don't have the bandwidth. Corey didn't want to, and I don't blame you, you know, manage all the VAT tax and all that kind of stuff. So Patreon is just the simplest way to support the show. So there'll be a link in the show notes if you want to join Patreon. It's $7 a month. There is no yearly option for this. Patreon.com/bookwormfm. And thank you to everybody who already signed up.
All right. So next, Mike, is your action items. So you were going to create an automatic or an autopilot schedule. Were you able to do that?
Yeah. So I'll actually cover the three of these sort of together.
Okay.
So the idea behind the autopilot schedule is that it's Monday at 3 p.m. This is when I do this. And I am still working on this, but essentially I am building this out. And one of the things that is sort of tangentially related to this is the implement the work cycles. This isn't exactly what I was talking about with the implement work cycles, but the idea with the implement work cycles is I want to do these like every eighth week, take it off essentially, like regular breaks, not just a vacation every once in a while when I feel like I'm submerging and I just need a little bit of time. Because every time I take a vacation like that, it usually, like the first several days, I'm just completely exhausted. By the time I'm actually starting to feel good about the vacation, it's time to go back to work, and then I feel depressed again. Like, hopefully people can relate to that cycle. But when you have these like regular breaks, then it's more sustainable in the long run. The first time you're like, oh, this is amazing, I should have done this a long time ago. The second time you're usually like, I don't want to take a break yet, I'm still good, there's stuff to be worked on. By the third time, you're just like, okay, yeah, this really makes sense and it allows me to do my best work. I used to do this sort of rhythm when I was at Blanc Media, and I want to do that for myself now. Okay, so that actually ties to my autopilot schedule, because I was thinking about my regular work week. And because I'm an elder at my church and we're there for both services, I play on the worship team, so I have to be there early both services. Sundays basically are not a rest day. They're more a work day than any other day of the week, to be honest. Mm-hmm. They're from 8 in the morning till 8 at night usually. And that means that Monday morning has always been hard. Yeah. And I realized it was because I was making it hard. So I would force myself a lot of times, like, okay, this is what I got to get done this week. Got to hit the ground running on Monday morning if I'm going to get all this stuff done. I'm finally at the point where I think, as part of my autopilot schedule, Mondays are going to be for finishing off the newsletter. So I've got it written at that point, but it's putting it all in ConvertKit, making sure the links all work. If there's anything tangential that needs to be added to that, like today when I sent mine out, I had to make sure that the link to join the community was available for the people who raised their hands early. They wanted to be notified when it was available, that sort of thing. So that's happening on Mondays. We're happen to be recording Bookworm on a Monday, which is a little bit weird, but normally there is a mastermind group that I'm a part of, which is later in the afternoon. And then Mondays is also the day that I do the one-on-one with my kids. So just putting that all on Monday and treating Monday essentially as an off day where I do just a little bit of work. I know those that doesn't jive. Like, it's not really an off day if I'm doing some work, but it also just sets up, I don't know, it feels really good. It feels like this is a really good rhythm. And then I'm not finding that Tuesday through Friday, I'm not able to get the rest of the stuff done. So I think this is really working. And then kind of taking that concept, you know, to the rest of my autopilot schedule, I've got, you know, Tuesdays are the days when Focus gets recorded. Thursdays, I've got these regular meetings. Wednesdays, you know, there's certain things that happen. Fridays are the Ask Me Anythings in the library, my community. So I'm kind of putting the pieces into place. But I'm also trying to limit the number of things that I am putting in these days, which is the other action item I had, which was simplify my daily schedule. So I'm not trying to, you know, three most important tasks and then all of the other things. I'm trying to just, if I have things on the calendar, those actually count.
Yeah.
And don't try to do too much. But also, I think one of the things that's helping with that is larger blocks of time and less context switching, which sounds so obvious. But as an example, I've got a Screencast Online tip video that I have to do. And instead of like working on that a little bit on this day, a little bit on the next day, and a little bit on the next day, I've just blocked a couple of hours where I can just sit down with nothing else to do and crank that out. And that has been helpful. So obviously, you know, I'm all in with the whole idea of slow productivity. These action items, there's nothing like super amazingly like transformative with any one of these, but I feel like I'm making progress on these and it is moving me in that slow productivity direction, which ultimately I think is a good thing.
Yeah, that's definitely a good thing. It sounds good in terms of the Monday routine seems reasonable. Like you know, my opinion on this that you didn't ask for, but it's like it seems like that makes sense with Sunday being so crazy that you need an ease into the focused work that happens on, you know, Tuesday through Friday. So that seems reasonable.
Yeah. And I guess one of the things that I didn't mention, but the bad habits, you know, full transparency, what had been happening was work had been slipping into Saturday, not all day Saturday, but there was basically always something that needed to be done on Saturday. Regardless of how early I hit the ground running on Monday. So I was like, okay, well, if Saturday is not turning into my day off, let's just put it out the other end. Let's make Monday the day off. And that's helped a lot. Actually, what's happened since I started doing that is that I've been having more time off on Monday and also less to do on Saturdays.
Yeah, it seems like a win-win on both ends of the spectrum. Yeah. All right, so I had four. Mine were to figure out the big and small. I was trying to do one project a day, figure out other pull system items, and then can I be more specific with my rituals and spaces? So I'll tell you two of these I was able to work on. The other two I was not. So figure out what's big and small. That I was able to think about that one and put in some good focused thought on that. I think what I got to partially is the fact that that's going to take a longer period of time, right? Like it's going to be a refining process. Like some of the things I think are big, I need to transition those into small And then some of the things that are small right now, I want them to be bigger. So therefore I need to transition those in. So it's like some of them I can just axe right now and I could say, okay, that's done. Like that's small. I'm not going to worry about that anymore. And I'm going to treat the big stuff as big. But then some of these ones, I noticed that there was a transition period that needed to happen. And I'm starting to figure out how that transition works and how I move one from the other to the other bin and move the other one back. The one project per day, not going to happen. Like that is just not in the cards for me in this season of life. I think, so with running an academic schedule, I think in the summers and then during like winter break where I have a larger block with less commitments, I think that's doable then, right? So I can say like, okay, today I'm going to work on this and that's the only thing I'm going to focus on, but I don't have to teach a couple classes and, you know, mentor students and advise students. Like I have the ability to not be so all over the place. The other pool system items, I'm probably just going to can that. I think I'll go back at some point and revisit pool systems and how those might work. But I just think that's going to take too much front end work right now in terms of me trying to set that up and trying to make sure other people understand it and how that works. And I'm just kind of not going to focus on that one right now. The can I be more specific with my rituals and spaces? I go on an adventure, Mike, all the time where I will set up a working space and it'll work for a couple months. And then something happens and it doesn't work anymore and I need to set up a different working space and I need to set up a different working space. And I'm honestly tired of doing that. I don't like doing that. It annoys my wife very, very badly. And then it also bothers me because I feel like I'm spending too much time setting up and tearing down and figuring things out. But the counter of that is I don't like setting up and tearing down a lot, right? Like, so if we're going to record an episode, I don't like to have to set everything up every time and then tear it down when I'm done. And if I'm going to write and I want to focus space, I don't want to have to do that. So I don't know the answer to this, but I've been like basically looking at every aspect of my house and like my workspaces and going, could that be the space? Could that be the space? Could that be the space? So like there's a space in my garage and I'm like, that could totally be the space in the summer. But then the winter comes and it's just a little too cold out there. Well, could I heat it? How much would it cost me to heat it? You know, like, so I run all those things through my head and I haven't landed on any specific place yet. And then with the number of children I have, I feel like they expand, right? Like, so they have owned the entire house and owned every corner of the entire house. And I can't figure out how to gain any of that back, to get some of that back. So like the Lego room and this other room, and then we need some storage, but it'll work out. I think we're going to land on a space here at some point. So that's nice. My update.
What you need is one of these rooms that I just shared in the chat. Yeah, you seen these?
I'm looking at this right now. Okay, so the funny thing about this, I told you, like, this is infiltrating almost every aspect of my life right now. I'm looking for spaces to work. I saw so at our church, we have the drummer inside the fishbowl. And I was like, I wonder if I bought a fishbowl and if I put that in the garage, could I then work inside the fishbowl and it would be less space to heat? And maybe that would work really, really well. But this looks like a fishbowl only, you know, times 1,000.
Yeah. So the website here is room.com. And essentially it's these little phone booth style things that you can pop into and they're completely soundproof. They used to have these at the day job. And the focus room is the one that I think you need.
Oh, yeah, but for $18,000, I don't think I need that, Mike.
Yeah, well, these are the original, but I think that there are a lot of knockoffs of these. And essentially, you could build something if you were handy. I am not handy, but if you were, you could, I'm sure, build something similar pretty easily. They're fairly straightforward. I don't think you can, like, download the plans or anything like that anywhere, but somewhere somebody has to have a version of this, you know. But I think this is a really cool idea.
That's my leading candidate right now. My leading candidate is to build a room like this inside of my garage, but I haven't convinced myself that it's worth it enough or that I'll use it enough to do this. So that was cool fair. Though. I like That's that. I did not know there's a website that sold these. That's amazing.
Yeah, I actually see Instagram ads for all of the knockoffs just because the type of internet activity I have.
How are Instagram ads so good? Like, they are so no idea. Good. It's unbelievable.
Yep, it's scary.
Unbelievable. Yeah. All right. Are we ready to launch into our book?
We are.
All right. So we did a book called Mastery by Robert Greene. And for those who are new to Robert Greene, I believe when I was reading up on him, he's got like 7 international bestsellers. I mean, he's written a lot of books that have become very popular. This book, it was written in 2012, 2013. It was written in 2012 and then kind of reprinted in 2013. It's got an introduction in 6 chapters. There is no conclusion, which I thought was really interesting. We'll talk about it as we work through it. He seems to have a system for his book writing. I don't know if you've noticed this or not, Mike, but like he'll pick interesting people or famous people or however you want to position that. And then he'll make a book out of talking about them. And like he'll grab their stories and then he'll make a book out of that. And it's very, if you look at his Wikipedia page, you can see the people he focuses on in the different books. And this book is no different. He did exactly that with a group of people. And you're going to hear us talk a lot about that process and those people. So we can go ahead and get started on the introduction. In the introduction, I mean, the book is called Mastery. So really what he's trying to introduce us to is this concept of mastery. The way he defines it is the feeling that we have a greater command of reality, other people, and ourselves. That's his like super duper high level kind of definition of mastery. But he goes into process and mirror neurons and what are the obstacles to becoming a master and what are the mindsets for achieving mastery. And then essentially what he does is he breaks each of these out throughout the introduction into each of the chapters. And it basically gives you a guide to thinking about these things, but then a bunch of examples from these other, I guess, famous folks' lives. So that's kind of setting the stage on it. What did you want to talk about, or what did you want to hit on as we set the stage?
Well, let me just say that we covered one other Robert Greene book for Bookworm prior to this one, before you joined the show, Corey, and I was not a fan. I actually liked this one a lot better, but it followed very much the same format. And that phrase, or the definition of mastery that you shared, the feeling that we have a greater command of reality, of other people, or ourselves, that when I read that, I was like, oh boy, here we go again. Because
really?
48 Laws of Power feels, and this isn't, I don't think, attributed directly to Robert Greene, but I mean, it's essentially how to wield power over other people to get what you want. So there is a very obvious negative application of that power that your mind instantly jumps to when you start reading those stories, and it feels very uncomfortable. At least it did to me. That, I think, though, is not what you get with mastery. I like mastery a lot better. And the two keys to motivation are the one thing I want to add to this from the introduction. The first one is that you must see your attempt at attaining mastery as something extremely necessary and positive. And then the second one is you must convince yourself that people get the mind and quality of brain that they deserve through their actions in life.
Yeah.
Which sounds kind of funny, but I also think it's very true. So essentially, the TLDR with mastery is that if you are not just putting in the time, so it's really not about the 10,000 hours, or later in the book, he says 20,000 hours
yes,
to really
does.
Become
yes.
a master. Those 20,000 hours, though, don't really matter if you're doing it wrong. And so that's really what the rest of the book is about, is approaching the work that you're trying to become excellent at the right way. And that second key, you know, kind of talks about, or it kind of leads into the fact that maybe there are people who are living at a level lower than they really are capable of. And the way that I read that was kind of like, yeah, you want to help people, but you can't just pull people out of that either. They have to make the decision.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like the people who are, you hear all these stories about people who are in a tough spot financially, they win the lottery and they end up back there. Because they just don't have the right mindset, the right financial management skills in order to steward all the wealth that they just acquired. So it in some ways, you know, it's really not the blessing that it appears to be on the surface. I think Robert Greene would say that everything worthwhile in life, you've got to earn. But when you realize that what you get is dependent on your effort, and if you do things the right way, that can actually be very freeing. I'm a big believer in the idea of self-determination, or my dad with the software business had an assessment skill building system called personal responsibility, mm-hmm. which was sold to like at-risk programs in schools, like inner cities, where you have kids who are at risk, not because of something that they did, but just the situation that they were born into. But the first step of getting out of that is to decide that you're not just going to let it be the way that it's always been, and you're going to do something about it. So I feel like this introduction does a really great job of setting the stage for the next, what are there, 6 different parts here? I guess they're chapters? I don't know.
they're chapters, but they sure didn't feel like chapters because, I mean, you're taking 350 pages and you're chopping it into like 7-ish sections, which, those are pretty long chapters there. Now he subdivides that in a way, but like there wasn't, in my perspective, there wasn't a lot of structure in terms of the subdivision, except for when he would say like, we're going to talk about the 7 strategies to do whatever, right? Like, so yep. then he would break that down, which I thought was good. As you were going through the introduction, that what stood out to you, the one other piece that I thought about, was he talks about your whole life being an apprenticeship. And I really, really like thinking like that. I really, really like that mindset of like, at any given time, I'm in a process of learning. At any given time, I'm in a process of, you know, trying to get to mastering and trying to develop and trying to grow. And I think that's a good way, maybe it's the educator in me, but it's like, I think that's a good way to approach life, right? It's like, I'm trying to learn some skill. I'm trying to grow. I'm trying to advance in some way. Where I got rubbed a little bit the wrong way, I would say, is the fact that like the people he puts out as the masters, right, that he refers back to, I don't know that there's a direct connection between if I do the things that he tells me, I'm going to achieve what they achieved or close to what they achieved. I think there's a very, very realistic path to where, hey, I can think about my whole life as an apprenticeship. I can work hard my entire life. I can stay open. I cannot fall to the obstacles of all this stuff. And I can still not achieve what these 6 or 7 people achieved in their life. And like, I don't think we really talk about that enough in the book. And I get why you wouldn't talk about that, but it's like, that kind of rubbed me the wrong way a little bit.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of potential overlap here with the 48 Laws of Power, but I'm kind of glad that it's not as explicit as I was worried it would be.
Okay. So chapter one then moves into, and I'm really intrigued to hear what you say about chapter one, because as the guy who runs the life theme cohort, right? Chapter one is called Discover Your Calling, The Life's Task. Now, I think there's a discrepancy here, but I don't want to bias you. So what did you think about the life's task? I'm intrigued with what you thought about that.
Well, first of all, it's kind of a clumsy term, if you ask me.
Yeah, I agree.
But there are 5 strategies he mentions for discovering your inclinations and life's task. Return to your origins, which is the primal inclination strategy. Occupy the perfect niche, the Darwinian strategy. Avoid the false path, the rebellion strategy. Let go of the past, the adaptation strategy. And find your way back, the life or death strategy. Those are all obviously different strategies that you could use to land on this life's task. So the process for this, regardless of the strategy that you use, is connect with your inclinations, your sense of uniqueness. With this connection established, look at the career path that you are on or about to choose and see your career path as a journey of twists and turns rather than a straight line. That is straight from the book. That is the process. What the heck does that mean?
I agree.
So I think this is actually pretty good. I appreciate that he's like leading people down thinking about these types of questions. And I don't think it's simple formulaic answer that you could just say, just do this and then you get it. So I'm not sure that there's a different approach really to be taken at this point. This is the place to start. But if I were to add to this, because as you mentioned, I do have the life theme cohort and I've coached people through this kind of thing, I think there are some other ways to get to the clues that can help you kind of lock into this. And then also the life's task, I feel like, is a little bit, I don't like that term. It feels like you pick one thing that you're going to do, and yeah, then that becomes the thing that your whole life is about. The life theme, and when I came up with that term, it was kind of like extending the yearly theme idea from the Cortex podcast. Like, well, if you've got a theme that you're filtering your decisions through for your year, what if you had that for like a larger time scale? Let's just call it a life theme. But I also tell people, like, your life theme can change. I've actually changed mine not too long ago. And my current version of it is I help people multiply their time and talent, leave a bigger dent in the universe. So the very short version, I'm a multiplier. So when I get an opportunity to do something, I ask myself, how do I think this is going to align with that life theme? It's not a life's task, and then this is a different task, so it's obviously no. This is an interesting task. Can I bring meaning and purpose to this thing? And if not, then it's an automatic no. Maybe I think that I can bring meaning and purpose to it, but once I start doing it, I realize, this really isn't the thing. Okay, well, now the personal retreat process comes in, because every 3 months I can reevaluate things. And just because I said yes to something 6 months ago doesn't mean it's still a yes for me today. So you have to look at all these different pieces. And I feel like you really can't do that justice in a single chapter, but also, you know, it's a fine place to start with the whole concept of mastery, I think.
Yeah, the part that I like that he did here was when he talks about figuring out your life's task, he separates it into three different sections, right? So there's the inward journey, there's then assuming that that's going well, right? Like you're working, should part of your vacation or what you're doing should be part of that when you figured out what that inward journey is. And then your mindset is realizing that like this journey or this thing that we're doing is the way we learn more and the way we adjust and the way we shift. Now, I wouldn't have been like, this is why I love having these conversations, right? Because I didn't realize that the word task bothered me as much as it did until right now, because trajectory, theme, context, right? Like all of those seem better. And then especially in this three-part series he gives, if I figure out the inward journey, right? Like I look at the patterns and like, what are my unique and what are my inclinations? Like, so for me personally, this would be teaching, education, learning, development, right? Like that's where I feel like I've got this inclination or this inner calling to continue to do this type of work. Well, okay, then it changes the way I think about my vocation, right? So vocation would be job, because now it doesn't matter where I'm doing that. Like you can teach and you can help people learn and you can like mentor and coach and do all these things in a bunch of different contexts. Okay, so why would I pick this context over this context? Well, maybe there's something I need to learn in that area, or maybe I've just got a random opportunity that came along in this other area. Like it takes some of the pressure off of the picking the perfect job kind of thing, right? Like, cause you often think about like, oh, I need to pick the perfect thing. No. If it's in that inclination area, if it's in that unique area, or what he would call life task, we would call life, you know, life theme. If it's in that area, you're good. Like just run that. And then the other one is the mindset of like, okay, if that changes, change. Stay within that theme, but allow that to change.
Yeah. And then coupled with this is a heavy emphasis on natural selection and evolution. So kind of biased with this is like, if you really want to make any sort of difference, you got to connect to this thing as early as you possibly can and make your entire life be about it, because you are just a blip in the universe, which I agree with that on some level. You know, I really liked 4,000 Weeks by Oliver Berkman, which essentially was that. He talks about this idea of cosmic insignificance theory, which the positive side of that is the entire universe doesn't depend on you following through and doing the thing. So don't put all the pressure on yourself that I guess I tend to do. But then also with that, like I'm changing my career and I'm not going to share my actual age. Let's just say I'm north of 40. Okay. Is it too late for me? I mean, based on the examples that he shares here, you might think so. He even says in some of the stories, the person was in their mid-20s and they were realizing that their life was passing them by. And so they decided to do this thing. So some of that stuff was like, I don't know if I agree with that. I personally believe that when you really are doing the thing that you are supposed to be doing at whatever stage in life, the compound effect kicks in and you now are not adding to your life, you are multiplying. So I kind of don't worry about that, but there's that tone throughout the entire book. And I don't know how that might influence somebody who is younger. Like younger Mike reads this, he probably thinks, okay, this is really important. I got to nail this down by the time I'm 25. And I'm not sure that that's healthy or helpful necessarily. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't get good stuff out of it. I just think like he probably doesn't even mean to lead people that way, but just that is a little bit of the tone that comes through. So you got to recognize that. And you also have to approach this plug for the reading workshop, I guess. Like you find the stuff that's useful and then you discard the rest.
Well, and I thought that was very relevant in this book because I thought there were certain things in here that were extremely useful and extremely valuable. And then there were other fairly long sections that I was like, okay, we could have just hacked this out of here and I would not have missed anything in this book. So that's good. I want to call out one thing. There is a section here and I don't remember where it is. I don't remember what chapter it's in, but he does talk about, I think it was Benjamin Franklin. Doesn't he talk about Benjamin Franklin doing really, really good work in the later part of his life and like acknowledging that like, hey, really good work in like your mastery phase might not achieve until the very end. But then he like kind of like pops his own balloon because then he's like, he had a lot more really, really good work to do. And then he died at like 83. And I was like, oh man, I was like, what if he'd have stayed alive?
I can't remember. So I definitely remember him talking about Benjamin Franklin. I feel like, I know that Cal Newport talked about Benjamin Franklin in Slow Productivity. So we heard a different version of that story of Benjamin Franklin's life in the last book that we read.
Yeah.
But obviously different details and different emphasis here, slightly different, I would argue. So I think maybe a little bit of that perspective. I kind of thought the same thing as I was reading about Benjamin Franklin, but then I realized, oh, maybe that's just a carryover from Slow Productivity. I'm not sure, you know, I did not go back and reread the section on Benjamin Franklin to see if I was accurate in like attributing, well, that's not exactly what Robert Greene is saying. He's using these stories to emphasize these points because this book is ridiculously long. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to find out online, and I cannot find it anywhere, how many words are actually in this book. But if the average nonfiction book is like 60,000 words, this has got to be like 120.
I agree. It was long.
It's over 300 pages, and it's tiny, tiny print. It's just like the 48 Laws of Power. I mean, there's, I would argue, not a whole lot of filler words in here, but this is, you know, this is a mammoth of a book to get through.
Yeah. I agree. Okay. So let's move to chapter 2. We'll get there when we get to style and rating, cause I'm sure we're going to have things to say about that.
Yep.
So I put you on the spot on chapter 1. I'll take chapter 2 in terms of intro and the listener to it. So, it's submit to reality, the ideal apprenticeship. So the point he's trying to make in this one is the fact that these individuals, I don't think we've actually talked about the individuals that he hits, and I won't remember them all, but, Da Vinci's one of them. Temple Grandin is one of them. There's a fighter pilot. Can you remember the name? I can't remember it off the top of my head.
Caesar something or other.
Yeah. There's a fighter pilot. Then there's I say his name wrong every time. He's German. Goethe. I forget how you say it.
Oh yeah. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. Goethe.
There you go. But so he's got these series of people, right? So what he does here is he pulls out some of these examples where they were apprenticed or they did an apprenticeship under certain other people. So, you know, one of the ones that he calls out here is Faraday and how Faraday did an apprenticeship under, I forget who his apprentice was, but another very, very popular scientist at the time. And then what he's trying to say is like, here are the keys to mastery from an apprenticeship standpoint. So I'm going to focus mastery in now just on this apprenticeship perspective, and I'm going to hit it in a bunch of different ways. What's the goal of your apprenticeship? What's the ideal apprenticeship have in it? What are apprenticeship mistakes? You know, what, how do you transition out of an apprenticeship? Those type of things. And then he even goes further on that. And he says, here are the 8 strategies for completing this idyllic apprenticeship. And then you can walk through what each of those are, right? Like value learning over money, keep expanding your horizons, revert to a feeling of inferiority, trust the process. And he goes through all of these. And at times he ties back into the examples that he gave originally. And at times he uses the example to set up the front end of it and then brings out his teaching points at the very end. And he kind of switches back and forth between those styles, which I don't have a problem with. And I thought they were effective. Other than if I thought some of them were a little too long. I thought he went on a little too long in certain situations. So the things that I'm going to say, like I got out of chapter 2, right? Again, so it's all about this apprenticeship, is like, what my major takeaway from this is, I wish we did more apprenticeships. I wish we lived in a world and in a society where this type of work was, I guess the process of doing it was more ingrained into our society. We are in an educational society, and it's funny for me to be saying this as somebody who works in education, but we live in an educational society. It's go learn. And when you're 21, now you go and essentially work for the first time, right? Maybe you've had a job, maybe you've had an internship, but really you haven't had any seasoned period of time where you've been doing work unless you did that intentionally. And I think there is such value in going and studying under somebody. Now, 5 to 7 years, I don't know about that. Like, I don't know if I think that's relevant. But like, this ties into the idea of gap year, right? Like, so if you do a gap year and you do it appropriately and you spend a strategic period of time learning something underneath the tutelage of somebody else who's an expert in that or who's a master in that, man, I think that's so valuable. And I just don't think we do that anymore. And it's not even part of our culture. And like that, I mean, out of all the stuff he says in this chapter, that was my like aha from this whole thing, was like, wow, I really wish there were more avenues for connecting apprentices and and mentors or masters, and figuring out a way that even if you did it informally and it was like part of the day, or you know, a couple hours a week, you went and you apprenticed under somebody. Man, I think we'd be so much better off for that professionally and personally as we move forward.
Well, I agree with you. I think, however, you don't need to let a lack of a formal apprenticeship necessarily stop you, the general you. As we talked about in the pro show, when you ask me what my apprenticeship looks like, I feel like I kind of have gone through an apprenticeship over the last several years as I've changed my career. However, I also think there's a dangerous side to this where you have to find a master. Because I think, yeah, you want someone who really understands something if they're going to be the ones who are going to show you the ropes. However, we live in the internet age, and you can connect with a lot of different people, and essentially you can have different apprenticeships in different forms a lot easier. You have a lot more access to people, but you got to be specific in knowing what exactly you're hoping to learn from this person. So if I know that I want to, I want to become a better at internet business as a solopreneur. Like, I can go study Justin Welsh very easily as the solopreneur guy. I can access the courses. I can join the communities. You know, you can get direct access to somebody a lot easier than you could back in the day. And I think that is pretty cool. But also, as we talked about, like, I have a little bit of a hard time embracing the idea of, yeah, you're just going to become my guru and I'm going to commit to you for the next 5 to 10 years, which is a lot of the stories that he told in the book. And a lot of them are historical examples, obviously, 1700s, 1800s, 1900s. So what I just described with the online stuff was obviously not an option. And I do think that there is a deeper level of this apprenticeship, which is, but there's probably a lot to be said for that. I just have a hard time thinking through like how that actually gets lived out in a positive, practical way. I think the steps are still great though. So like there's these three steps to the apprenticeship phase where you go through deep observation, you observe the rules, you observe the power relationships that exist within the group. Step two is the skill acquisition. And this is where you start with one skill that you can master and that serves as a foundation for acquiring the others. And then there's the experimentation or the active mode where you step out, you embrace the criticism, and you start to think about new ways that you can do things. And that's kind of when stuff just becomes like second nature. So that's really the goal, right? He talks about that in this chapter, is to transform your mind and body, where this just becomes tacit knowledge. It's a feeling for what you're doing. It's hard to put into words, but it's easy to demonstrate and put into action. So I think the biggest thing that is holding people back from embracing an apprenticeship mindset, not necessarily going through a formal apprenticeship, but he talks about two kinds of failures, never trying out your ideas because you're afraid and making mistakes with a bold and venturesome spirit. That's the kind that you can learn from. I feel like the opportunities are there for just about everyone to learn from an apprenticeship relationship. But the thing that will keep people from doing it, I think, is that they don't want to look like a fool. Mm-hmm. You have these people who are, in the past, I've called them my internet heroes, right? You don't want to look like an idiot in front of them. So you don't ever say anything. You don't enter the conversations that are happening in the appropriate way to actually get better, because you don't want to make a mistake. And if you're too afraid to make a mistake, then you're never going to become great at the thing. That's really what apprenticeship is, I think, in if I were to summarize this, is admitting that you don't know very much and being willing to learn from people who know more than you do.
So you said, you know, you talked about like the tangible side of this and what it would be like. So Mike, if somebody came to you and they were like, okay, I want to be a solopreneur content creator on the internet, will you apprentice me? Like, what would your gut reaction be? And let's say like, let's get the character personality side out of it, right? It's purely you've already vetted them. You know that they would be okay, that they would not come in and like wreck your whole situation. But like, would you entertain it?
The only reason I hesitate is because I feel like I don't know enough about it to actually help someone in that situation. Now, if you're telling me, hey, teach me how to read books better. Yeah, that's kind of what the workshop is. It's a mini apprenticeship, yeah. Right? So I also think, though, that you have to, with the internet, the best way that this gets lived out is when you apply one of ConvertKit's values that I really like: teach everything that you know. You don't have to get to the point where you are an expert before you are sharing the things that you know. So with the internet, you know, I think there's a lot of nuance with that question. I need to know specifically who you are and what stage you're at. Because if I have gone through what you are going through and I can help you, then yes, I am absolutely willing to do that. But that doesn't mean like, okay, give me $50,000 and I'm going to teach you everything that you need to know. That's kind of what the library is for, in a sense, is like, you can make these small bets. You can enter these conversations where the stakes are lower. And then if you really want to go deep, usually there are opportunities for you to do that as well. I'm working on that type of stuff for the library. Yeah. Right now, there is nothing else for people who really want to work with me other than the $100 a year to join the membership or sign up for one of the cohorts. But as I develop more mastery myself, I think those opportunities to walk people through that process will present themselves. They kind of already are in the areas of like PKM and the life theme stuff. But then essentially, you know, I'm not going to step outside my, what is it, zone of genius, whatever. Like I'm not going to pretend like I know more than I know. I'm going to recognize that I'm a traveler on this path as well. And I'm not going to pretend like I have all the answers.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the reason I asked the question is like I have a little bit of a different, I don't know if it's different or just a different nuance or spin to it, but it's like if somebody came to me, which this happens all the time in education, right? Somebody comes to me and they're like, hey, I want a student teach under you, or, you know, I would want to apprentice, you know, from a classroom management perspective. And that maybe is the wheelhouse you're talking about where you narrowed it down and said like, yes, this is my zone of expertise. Like I would have no problem with them coming in as long as they knew from the beginning, I don't have it all figured out. I don't have it all together, but sure, I've been in a classroom longer than you have. And if you want to come in and learn some things that work and some things that don't, that'd be great. I don't think I'd have any problem bringing them in.
Well, education, I feel like, is a little bit different because in order to get in front of the class, you have to have the credentials, right? What are the credentials that I have earned?
Experience.
Teach people stuff online. Yeah, that's about it, though. Like with education and with medicine specifically, like there are all of these formal channels that you have to go through. And so the fact that you have the letters at the end of your name means that you know what I want to know. It's a lot harder to verify that with just solopreneur guy online.
we'll make up some letters for the back of your name.
That's why the testimonials and the social proof are such a big deal. You know, you go to a course and you see, you know, do I recognize anybody who is saying nice things about this? Because you want to know that they can actually get you where you want to go.
Yeah. All right. So let's move to chapter three. So chapter three is absorb the master's power, the mentor dynamic. I do not like the name of this chapter at all. The title of this chapter at all. So absorb the master's power. Now the content I'm actually okay with, but like the name is, it just doesn't do it for me. So again, he has this section. I guess if there was a substructure in the book, he has subsections in some of these chapters, maybe all of them, that are its keys to mastery, right? So how do you master this thing? And then he goes through and kind of gives you strategies for it. But the first thing that he's going to start talking about in this chapter is how do we find the right master? How do we use books to temporarily serve in a place where we can't get a master? It's okay to have multiple masters or multiple mentors as you work through this. Then he says that he has a whole section on how to get the most out of this mentor or most out of this master. And there's four steps in this one. He's choose the right mentor according to your needs and inclinations. So he ties this back to what he would call the life task. If the mentor doesn't relate to the life task, what are you doing? You're picking the wrong mentor. Gaze deep into the mentor's mirror. You know, so this one gets a little interesting, but it's like, you kind of have to stop somewhere, right? So you have to figure out where the mentor is going to stop being able to mentor you and then move that one. That's kind of like the mirror thing. And then transfigure their ideas. So you can't just replicate exactly what they do. You take what they do, you spin it with your own uniqueness and your own perspective, and then it ends up becoming different, maybe better, hopefully better in your mind than what they worked with you on. And then create a back and forth dynamic. So how do you adapt and learn and grow and go back and forth? And I can tell you that from my experience in like the closest, it's definitely a mentor advising relationship, but the closest apprenticeship relationship I've had, this back and forth is huge. When you can tell when you reach that phase where it becomes less of a true mentee mentor situation and they're coaching you almost all the time and where they almost start to treat you like a colleague. And like, you're not officially a colleague yet, but like, it's very, very close and you feel it, like, because they start to get your opinion and ask you questions. And like, it's much less a, I'm going to teach you this or coach you this. It's much more of a, we're going to have a conversation about this. And I'm really hoping to get stuff out of you just as you're hoping to get stuff out of me. And it's a really, really fun time in that situation. I'll give the listeners an example of like one of the case studies that he uses. So he uses Manny Pacquiao and his boxing coach, Roach, was the guy's last name. So basically, Roach develops this new style of training his boxers where he puts on these big mitts and he basically tries to mimic the opponent for the fighter, right? So he figures out what the ticks are on the fighter and like where they have flaws and where they have weaknesses. And then that helps the person he's training kind of see those things before the fight and like be able to take advantage of those things before the fight. But what he learns through this is, like, basically Pacquiao would make suggestions on how he would do certain things. And then he would, they would have this back and forth, and basically they both got better. He got better. Roach got better as a trainer. Pacquiao got better as a fighter. And there was this back and forth dynamic that evolved, or that happened throughout the course of their training together. And for those of you who don't know anything about boxing, I mean, Pacquiao just absolutely owned the sport in his weight class for a very, very, very long time. So it was a very effective and a very beneficial relationship for both of them.
Yeah, I want to go back to the books can serve as temporary mentors.
Really? I'm surprised you'd want to go back to there.
I thought about interrupting you before you got too far down that trail there, but I resisted.
Good job.
I disagree that they are temporary mentors. I feel like books are one of the most amazing inventions ever. I mean, you have access to some of the greatest thinkers and the most revolutionary ideas to ever be shared, and you can get them for free at a public library. That is amazing. Mm-hmm. And if you would have told somebody prior to Gutenberg's press that this would be a thing, they'd be like, yeah, right. And I feel like we've kind of lost the value of this because the internet has lowered the barriers so far that people can publish crap with no barrier to entry. Mm-hmm. So it's becoming really hard to filter out what's the good stuff and what's the junk. And if you want to find the good stuff, just go buy something with a binding on it, because it's a lot harder to actually have an idea worth sharing. And that's the kind of the litmus test for that. So I think that this has been very important to me, obviously. And I think coupled with this is a little bit of a difference of opinion with how this dynamic actually works. I'm not disagreeing that the best version of this happens in person, person to person. If you are committing to a mentor for the next 5 to 7 years and there's one person that you're going to spend the majority of your time with, yeah, you want to be with them day to day, every day. However, I don't live in a place where those types of mentors, at least for my professional stuff, they're not around me. So what do I do? Do I pack up my family and move to Austin, Texas? You know, I've thought about that. I could go hang out with Ryan Holiday at the Painted Porch, right? I'm not going to do that. And I would argue that that is not limiting my professional options just because I'm not physically in the same location. Maybe it lowers my chances of being mentored by Ryan Holiday, but also just being in the same location doesn't mean that you're going to have the access to that relationship either. So I feel like there's a historical bias here where cities were the places where these ideas were shared, and you did have to be in those places, engaging in those conversations in order to even have a chance for these apprenticeships to present themselves. And that I think is changed. So I think the question you have to be asking as you go through this whole book, and I hope I'm not going to just harp on this every single chapter, but we have to think differently about what are we trying to get out of this whole idea of apprenticeship, and what are the different ways that we can apply ourselves and develop these skills. Now, there is something that is important here that he talks about. To learn requires a sense of humility. So you have to believe that there are others that are better than you are. And that's hard to do online. Everyone wants to project, oh, I've got it all together and I know everything, right? But you aren't going to learn that way. But he also says that if you work on yourself first and you develop a strong work ethic and organizational skills, the right teacher will appear. I 100% agree with that statement, but the right teacher is going to appear in different ways now than, you know, in 1800. Now, the right person appearing might be, I'm trying to become a better writer. So I buy this course and then I go through this and I see other people talking about this tangential thing and holding up the work of this other person as like a example of quality. Oh, I'd never heard of that person before. I'm going to go study their work. And that is a very valid approach, I think, to learning the skills that you need to learn. And that's where I say like books can absolutely serve as more than temporary mentors. Having read, I don't know, there's probably something like 500 books in the last 8-9 years since I first started the Bookworm podcast and all the Gap books and things that came before that. There's 188 versions of the mind map notes in the community for people who are interested. I recognize that there is value to be gained through the quantity as well. So books can't just be like, you know, I'm really stuck on this problem. I wonder if there's a book. The reading life has to be developed, but I think it's also a very important part of modern day apprenticeship. If you're neglecting books as a way to develop skills, you are hindering yourself. And it's kind of amazing to think about how much access we have to this stuff. So let's take advantage of it.
Yeah. All right. Anything else on chapter 3?
No, I don't think so. I think the absorbing the master's power feels a little bit weird. I agree. It feels almost like science fiction-y.
Yeah.
I think, though, hidden in that phrase is something that he didn't speak directly to, but as a parent, you maybe kind of get it. As a parent, you want your kids to go further and do more than you did. And I feel like when you have a real apprentice relationship like that, and it doesn't have to be, again, the formal apprentice relationship. There have been people who in my life, there are currently people in my life who I look up to and they recognize the fact that, you know, I am just absorbing everything that they are willing to share. They are mentors in my life. And I think they would say the same thing. Like, it's rewarding to them to invest in someone who actually wants to hear what they have to say and actually and put it into practice. So I think if you understand that, it's probably kind of natural for the master to want to launch the apprentice at some point past where they've been able to go.
Yeah, I can tell you that I've seen situations where they haven't wanted to launch that. And yep. Man, it never ends well, right? It really does not end well because everybody ends up getting bitter in the end, and it's a bad situation. But yes, that would be the hope, is they would launch. All right, chapter 4, Mike. I felt like chapter 4 kind of came out of nowhere. And it's not that it didn't relate eventually, but like chapter 4 is see people as they are, social intelligence. So if I think about this from we're working down this list, right? We go from here's the idea of mastery. Let's get apprenticeships. Let's absorb everything we can from the master. And then let's figure out basically how to interact with that person and like interact with them well through social intelligence. But like the way most of this chapter worked, it was basically like, I want to write a little, not little, fairly large section on social intelligence. But it's like, I didn't need nearly this much depth or breadth, like from a social intelligence standpoint. So let me give the overview, unless you want to chime in right now, I'll give you the opportunity.
Well, I want to ask you a question. What the heck is social intelligence?
Yeah. Okay. Good point. Okay. So I don't know the answer to that. That's why I'm going to move straight forward. But like we unpack important components, specific knowledge, and then general knowledge of human nature. We unpack the 7 deadly realities, right? Which envy, conformism, rigidity, self-obsessiveness, laziness, flightiness, passive aggressiveness. Then the 4 strategies for social intelligence: speak through your work, craft the appropriate persona, see yourself as others see you, suffer fools gladly, right? Like all of this stuff is not bad. I don't think any of this is bad. I just felt like it was kind of like, and we're going to detour, but it's going to be like a really big detour, right? Like we're going to go from, you know, this is a very American reference, right? But we're going to go from like New York to Portland through Mexico. And I was like, wait, what are like, what are we doing? Right? Like, why are we going the whole way down there? That said, I think this is a really interesting section on human nature. I think it's a really interesting section on some general good ideas to avoid. The seven deadly realities, right? Like, if we avoid those things, we're going to be in a much better situation than we are if we have those in our life and they're impacting our relationships. The four strategies for social intelligence, I think those are really, really good in terms of, advancing your work or helping you not get stuck in these obstacles. So that's my general take on chapter four, and that we can get more specific after you give us your commentary.
So the title, first part of the title, see people as they are. I like that. The concept of social intelligence, I think that's mislabeled. I think what he's really talking about here is emotional intelligence, which has a social aspect to it. I used to work for a family business that has a emotional intelligence assessment and skill building product, not the personal responsibility piece that I mentioned earlier, but another product called the Success Profiler, which, and this is going to color my bias on this, which is why I'm sharing this. That product has been used something like 8.5 million times and has 120 doctoral level papers and books written on it. So like huge research basis, right? Emotional intelligence is a thing, let me tell you. And it's hard to measure. So primarily family business sells to school systems where the focus is on test scores and did your kids graduate, especially with like special education programs. It's did they do what they needed to do for their IEPs? And we're not necessarily concerned about the social aspect of this. I mean, if you were to ask a teacher, yes, obviously they are concerned about it, but how in the heck do you teach that stuff? How do you test for that stuff? How can you measure that stuff? Well, there are tools, but it's difficult. Okay, so when I am thinking about emotional intelligence, I'm thinking about a couple different aspects of this. There's an intrapersonal part of this, which is how do I deal with my own emotions? And that kind of he talks about with the naive perspective, which is viewing people out of our own emotional needs. So if you don't have intrapersonal emotional intelligence skills, then everything feels like a big deal. You can't see things how they really are, and you're projecting that on everybody else. But there's also the interpersonal piece of this, which is how do I communicate effectively? And this is where like all of the other emotional intelligence skills typically get measured. And one of them that I really like is called sales orientation. Essentially, it's leadership. And every time people go through that, they're like, oh, I don't want to be a salesperson. I hate this scale. And I'm like, well, are you married? Because if you are, you're a salesperson. You've sold yourself at least once. Sales is really the belief that you can get people where they want to go. And so there's a lot that goes into this. And I feel like when he's talking about in this chapter is how to manage the complexities of relationships effectively. Now, there are complexities in the relationship with the master that you may be apprenticing under that you kind of alluded to, where maybe they don't have the emotional intelligence skills and they're not seeing things right, where they're launching you as the apprentice at some point. I've seen that too. So that doesn't mean that you can't learn from them, but you got to go into it with your eyes open and not just blindly trusting this person. And then all of a sudden it's like, well, I thought they were going to do this and they didn't. I'm the victim here. No. Recognize what's going on here, and again, use what you can, better yourself. You're not trying to use the master and then just discard them. That was one of the scientist examples that you alluded to earlier. That was kind of my take on that apprenticeship model. It was like at some point, the guy that he was apprenticing under wasn't willing to share the spotlight, but the apprentice had gotten so good that he's like, well, okay, I can't grow here anymore, so I'm going to go do something else. He didn't like throw his master under the bus or anything like that. So you got to be, don't be a jerk. But then there are also like all of the people, if I'm in a day-to-day job, these are all my coworkers that I have to manage my relationship with them effectively. And I'm not just talking about like the suffer fools gladly, although that could be applied here. I mean, there are people that you work with probably who are not helping you as much as they are needing something from you. I remember Michael Hyatt did a blog post about this a long time ago about this two types of people in the world, people who have their own battery source and those who don't. And the ones who have their own battery source, they bring life and energy to every meeting that they're a part of. And the ones who don't, you got to like pull them along. And you can identify people from your own work situations that fit those two different categories. So that's what I'm thinking of as suffer fools gladly, is like, this person is part of this team. And yeah, it's going to be a little bit harder to work with them, but it's necessary. Doesn't mean that I'm going to spend all my time working with them. I'm going to do what I need to do with them. And then I'm going to go where I'm celebrated, not just tolerated. There's people who are easy to work with and we can do something awesome a little bit easier. Right. And I used to, in the past, get offended and I'm not saying this is right, but like I would get so frustrated whenever I was in one of those situations that it became evident, I feel, to everybody else who was there. When I felt like this was a waste of time, like you knew it. So I feel like I'm getting better at hiding that stuff. And that's what he's talking about here. So I feel like the topic is important, but I don't really like the approach that he took. And I feel like obviously I'm biased here, but there's another way to tackle this, which makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, and I don't think it needed to be any longer for sure, but like it was like maybe social and emotional intelligence, right? And hitting both sides of that, and that's a way you could have structured chapter four and saying like,
well, that's what they call it in the schools, social emotional learning. Like they are coupled.
So that might have made more sense. I did like a quick search on it. I was like, I wonder what emotional intelligence, like what's the first reference on Wikipedia to like this? But I can't easily find that. I can tell you that it's early. It's fairly early. It's before this book was written. So clear. All right. Chapter five, awaken the dimensional mind, the creative active. Now, as somebody who's thought about creativity a lot, I'm intrigued at your perspective on this. I'll give a very, very light overview and then I'll let you take off. So basically he calls out that what's the dimensional mind? It's active, creative. It's got a childhood spirit. We're trying to then unlock the dimensional mind. He'll say the two essential requirements are a high level of knowledge about something and then an openness and flexibility to think new and original, right? That's what he would call the dimensional mind. Then the other major section of this one is basically the nine strategic approaches to being most creative. I did not personally think this was the most interesting part of this section. I thought this was kind of like, okay, yeah, that's fine. But I'll go through the nine real quick. Authentic voice, fact of great yield, mechanical intelligence, natural powers, the open field, the high end, evolutionary hijack, dimensional thinking, and then alchemic, creative, and the unconscious. And part of the reason why I didn't think I liked these is because I don't think you get very much from those titles at all. You can read those titles and be like, I have no idea what this guy's talking about. And for me, that's a problem. So I will stop and I will let you take on the creative first.
I agree with you 100% that you don't get a whole lot out of those. In fact, this chapter, I have the most notes on and I didn't write down those at all because I felt they were not very useful. I do think this is a really good chapter, by the way. He's got a lot of good stuff to talk about here. You kind of hit on a little bit with the dimensional mind. Let me share the definitions for the conventional and the original mind here, because the dimensional mind is blending them. Conventional mind is you force your mind into tighter and tighter grooves in order to make a living and conform to society. And that has negative connotations, but I feel like your mind it's naturally going to do that. That's your body's efficiency mechanism. It's going to try to make a routine out of everything. Then you've got the original mind, which is naturally creative, actively transforming everything around them to play with ideas. So the dimensional mind is the blending of the two, where you've got discipline and a childlike spirit are the two terms that he used there. And I like that a lot. So you've got the discipline where you're going to show up every day and you're going to do the work. There's that famous quote, I forget the author, but I only write when inspiration strikes. Fortunately, it shows up promptly at 9 a.m. every morning. So that's the discipline part, but then also the childlike spirit. I mean, we're probably familiar with that from a different phrase, having faith like a child, where you're just constantly, maybe curious is the right word. You don't feel scared or intimidated about playing with these different ideas, and you never know which one you're going to get completely sucked into. And that is ultimately, I would argue, a good thing. Now, there's also some stuff he talks about later on in here that I think are good, like tidbits. I don't think there's a whole lot here in terms of actual effective creative structure. And I say that as somebody who has a model called the Creativity Flywheel. So maybe I'm biased there too. Mm-hmm. But I'll just share a couple of the things that I liked here. So the primary law of the creative dynamic is that your emotional commitment to what you are doing will be translated directly into your work. So if you want to be creative, you can't just be deadline driven and be like, oh man, I got to crank out 500 words by tomorrow. It's got to be stuff that you love thinking about and that you are curious about. And that's the, you know, the dimensional mind and that original mind coming through. That has to be there. The negative capability is the ability to endure and even embrace mysteries and uncertainties. This is underrated, I think. This is at the heart of some of the advice that I'll share in the reading workshop. Is like, if you're not sure what book to pick up next, think about a problem that you've been wrestling with. Richard Feynman has this concept of like the 12 favorite problems, where you're constantly just thinking over these problems that you don't understand for months, maybe even years, not knowing the answer. That's this negative capability. It's being okay not having the answer and constantly just kind of searching the horizon for when that thing is going to show up. But if you're like, I have to have this thing by 4 p.m. on Friday, you're never going to get it. he also talks about how the brain is an instrument developed for making connections. I feel like that is really why I am so fascinated by the concept of PKM, or personal knowledge management. I like the idea of being able to see how things connect together. I think the big like graph views in Obsidian and apps like that, where you've got all those little dots connected, I feel like those sorts of views, they look cool on social media, but they are absolutely useless. However, the local graphs where you can see like this note's connected to this note, and then when you go to that note, you see, oh, there's another connection here. And as you kind of surf through things, you can see things connecting down the chain. Like that's pretty cool. And then the greatest impediment to creativity ultimately is your impatience. You've got to get it done and it's got to be great and it's got to be done now. Like, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
If there was a place where he basically like had a, you know, a map and he could look directly into my brain, or sorry, like a magnifying glass, look directly in my brain, it was in the emotional pitfalls around creativity: complacency, conservatism, dependency, impatience, inflexibility, and greed. And I was like, yes, 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 yes.
Yeah.
And then you mentioned it and I want to double down on it, right? Like, the primary law of creative dynamic, the emotional commitment, right? Like, and I feel like that's my biggest struggle with being creative and doing creative things is like, am I really committed to this thing? And am I committed to it long enough to really demonstrate those creative outputs, right? Mm-hmm. And that's where, you know, like that's one of the major struggles I have.
Well, there's another thing that's kind of related to that here. So your mind rises to the level required, and the lack of intensity keeps the brain from kicking into a higher gear. So if you really want to have consistent, prolific, creative output, I think you do have to get to the point where you are kind of forcing yourself to show up and do it. And when you do that, you might be surprised of what you are actually capable of. But that has to be coupled with this creative process and the playing with the ideas and not putting things out there before they're ready. Now, I recognize that those are kind of contradictory. That's why the Creativity Flywheel exists, is because I was thinking through, you know, back when I was with Asian Efficiency, I had to, in addition to write things for the blog, in addition to creating the outlines and hosting the episodes for the productivity show, I had to create from scratch a different productivity video course every single month. And I didn't know what I didn't know. So when they asked me to do it, I'm like, yeah, sure, why not? And I look back at it now and I'm like, how the heck did I do that?
Yeah.
And it was essentially because I was constantly reading. I was constantly learning. I was constantly curious. And when I was actually going through that stuff and taking notes and then looking back at my notes, there was always enough content to be made. So you have to kind of get into this rhythm. And sometimes the thing that you need in order to like kickstart that rhythm is you do need a deadline. You do need to force yourself to ship something, because I think it was the last episode we were talking about the slide I made from the creativity presentation where it was the quantity produces the quality. And you've got like the poop emoji and then the poop emoji, diamond, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone loved that one. Yeah. The first time you make something, it's going to be bad. The second time that you make something, it's still going to be bad. It's going to be a little bit better. But by the fourth, fifth, the 100th time, you've gotten pretty good at the thing. I'm not a great podcaster. I've just made like 1,000 episodes at this point. So the stress and anxiety of showing up to talk into a microphone is not the same as it was the first time that I did it.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right. So let's go to the sixth and final chapter. Fuse the intuitive with the rational and then mastery. So fuse the intuitive with the rational, mastery. So again, he's got a keys to mastery section here where you basically, he says, masters have a sensation of the sudden heightened intellectual power, the intuition or fingertip feel. High level intuition is distinct from rationality, kind of makes a distinction between those two things. The higher level intelligence, okay, he talks about basically like putting things into practical use, looking for connections, looking for deep reflections, looking for questions, and looking for how we learn from this. A lot of this chapter then is taken up with, how many are there? Seven. There's like seven, basically revisit the people we've talked about, and then we're going to try to glean a couple things out of those from a how they fused together and became a master. So again, I'm not a big fan of the titles because I don't think the titles really helped me get what I was supposed to get out of the thing. I think when he got to the end and he would like summarize it, so he would do like a paragraph or two at the end of every story where he'd summarize it, that all came together nicely. But like if I look at my mind map here and I look at the title and then what I got out of it, it was like, yeah, there's maybe a connection there. Like maybe connection there.
Wait. You said look at the mind map. Did you do a mind map for this book?
I've done a mind map for all of the books since I started.
Okay,
to do mind
maps. I know you were talking about the mind maps, and then you're like, I don't know if I'm going to stick with this.
No, I like it. I like it.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, I like them. It's a very, very good way for me to organize my brain, right? As you would know, very well. But like I said, I some of them are clearer connections, and other ones I thought, you know, weren't as great. And it's just too much content. I mean, to go through in detail all seven of them and what they covered. But he again defines mastery here, the ability to get very specific in knowledge, but also remain expansive in the dimensions of reality or contextual relationships. So I think what would be fun to do, which I didn't do, it's not an action item, but it would be interesting to do, is go back and like try to peg out every time he gave more detail about what mastery is, and then try to lump all those together into a, this is what Robert Greene says mastery is and what the characteristics of it are.
Yeah. I like to think of this chapter as the Star Wars chapter.
Okay, I'm intrigued.
So he has this term he introduces called the dynamic, which is the living force that inevitably operates in anything we study or do.
I never even once put that together. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I mean, the rest of this is kind of a summary about mastery, but he talks about the ultimate reality being that all beings are interconnected. So definitely some Star Wars vibes here. I think there's, you know, set aside the Star Wars piece, there's some actually useful stuff here. Like he talks about on page 261 that you must see every setback, failure, or hardship as a trial along the way, as seeds that are being planted for further cultivation if you know how to grow them. A couple reasons why that stood out to me. I talked about the creativity flywheel briefly. When I explain that to people, I talk about your PKM system, or the place where you're capturing your notes. That's kind of like an idea greenhouse. So I talk about how when you capture things, they are seeds and you don't really know what you have to work with until you give them the right conditions and you cultivate them for a little bit. So I like that a lot, but also kind of zooming out from that, essentially like everything that you feel is wrong or this is a setback and this shouldn't be happening, you kind of have to take the approach of it's all going to be fine. This too shall pass. Like it's the obstacle is the way, essentially. Yep.
I had a reference earlier to so good they can't ignore you. So good job. I'm glad we're getting all these.
Well, side note with that, in the end of the book, he has like the people that he thanks. He thanks Ryan Holiday. So Ryan Holiday actually did a lot of the research for this book.
Ah, I didn't see that.
Yeah. So it makes a lot of sense that all these stories and all the details that he's sharing, I was like, these sound familiar. Like not the same stories, but the same sort of style. Like he has a very similar storytelling style to Ryan Holiday. And I was like, well, that makes sense.
Wow. I had no idea that connection. I didn't make it that far in the acknowledgments.
Yeah. So, I think this is a great, actually a very great way to end the book. I feel like it's kind of setting the stage for like, okay, so there's this, all these different steps that we've talked through. Now you could just do these things, but essentially it's not just going to click and it's going to be awesome from that moment forward. You do have to sort of stick with it. And then the other thing that I jotted down here, the page 269, mastery is not a function of genius or talent. It's a function of time and intense focus applied to a particular field of knowledge. So it's almost like the TLDR of the last chapter here is trust the process.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is a good way to end a 320 page book, but it's not 320 pages. I don't even know how many words. I still can't find it, but it's gotta be like 100,000 words, maybe twice. It's gotta be like twice as long as your normal productivity self-help type book, but it's very much, you know, Robert Greene. If you read 48 Laws of Power, it's the same sort of deal here, but I thought this is a really cool way to end it. I don't mind that it's abrupt and there's no like conclusion.
Yeah.
By the time I got done with this chapter, honestly, I was ready to be done with the book because it's so long.
Well, and the next section was basically he does like biographies for all the people that he covered, and then acknowledgments, and it's absolutely done. All right. So anything else before we get to action items from this book?
Nope. Do you have action items?
I have one, and my action items, I don't know, Mike. You, like, feel free to call me out if you think my action items are not worthy of the Bookworm podcast. But like the one I want to think about is I really would like to apprentice under somebody. Like I would like to establish like an apprenticeship relationship with somebody. My challenge with it is I don't know what it's going to be in. Like I don't know where I would want to do that. And then the other thing is I don't have any idea where I'm going to get the time to do something like that. Like I, you know, with having as many children as I have and, you know, life and commitments and all that stuff. I what I'll commit to on the action item is I want to think about the realistic person, because the person I mentioned in the pro show is not realistic, right? Like I don't think that's a realistic apprenticeship, but I want to think about a realistic person that I could apprentice under, and then maybe in the future think about whether or not I try to set up that relationship. That's it. That's the only one I have out of this.
Well, I read a whole bunch of words and have zero action items.
is that good or bad, Mike?
I don't think it's either. I think it is evidence of the fact that I've been thinking about a lot of the themes and concepts that he talks about in this book for a long time, and I have already chosen to pursue them in my own ways. Now, there were a lot of things that I jotted down here, which I'm going to continue to noodle on. But I also think this has a very particular bias towards the physical apprenticeship. And that's not something that interests me in the least, to be honest.
Wow. You said well, in the least. You're strong on that. I'm not judging. I'm just, you're strong on that. Not even in the
well,
least.
Okay. Let me say this. The last 10 months of trying to run my own business have been the hardest 10 months of my life.
Okay.
And I feel like I am still in survival mode. So I don't feel like I have the margin to go find somebody to apprentice under. Now, if someone were to come to me and be like, hey, I'm going to take care of all your bills, all your debt. You're not going to have to worry about money ever again. Just come learn this thing from me. Yeah, let's talk.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, that makes total sense. All right, so let's move on to style and rating. It's my book, so I go first, right?
Yep.
Okay, so I want to give this book 3 stars. And I'm going to give it 3 stars based purely on content. From a style standpoint, it was meh. It was okay, right? I don't feel like, yay, it was great. Like, I didn't not like the whole, here's a character, now I'm going to pull, you know, examples from that of the points I want to talk about. But I just, it felt clunky sometimes. And I was like, okay, I understand this example, but does it really relate to the thing you're trying to tell us? And sometimes I just wanted him to be more direct in terms of style. So I thought the content was good. Like, I was happy with what he covered, with the exception of, I would say, I guess, what was I strong on? That like social intelligence piece just felt like it was like really kind of out of nowhere. But otherwise, I was good on the content. So 3 stars.
All right. I never would have guessed prior to this discussion that I would rate this higher than you, but I'm going to give it 4 stars.
Okay.
The reason I'm going to give it 4 stars, I think, I agree with everything that you said about the 3-star rating. However, I don't know that I have found a better book for the, I got to come up with a term for this, the apprenticeship mindset. I don't know. Like, really, this is sort of growth mindset, sort of self-help, but I don't even really like that term. Like, there's a lot of truth in here about becoming the best version of yourself. And that's a really important idea to me, that we have talents and abilities that are inherent and we have to cultivate them. We have to develop them. And ultimately, we're going to be held responsible for our excellence in stewarding those things. So I feel like there's lots of stuff in here that I was like, yeah, this is, you know, very much things that we should be thinking about. I tend to verbalize all the little nitpicks that I have with stuff because I feel it's probably a little bit more interesting in terms of listening to a podcast. But there's a lot of stuff that I really agree with in here. And I don't think if I were to attempt to write a book about this same topic, that it would look anything like what he's got here. I think we have a lot of differences of opinion, but I also feel like I was able to glean a lot from this, even though I don't have specific action items associated with it. Maybe it's because it's from such a different perspective that it helps me kind of fill in some of the blanks, like get some additional puzzle pieces. I guess for context, we read a book a while back called Liminal Thinking by Dave Gray, which really impacted me. And it was really about how we tend to build all of our beliefs and all of our theories and live our lives according to this sliver of experience that we have, but there's so much more that we don't know. And you kind of have to seek out and embrace, we'll say, contradictory mindsets if you want to get a better picture. This was definitely a contradictory book to me in a lot of ways, but ultimately I feel like that was a helpful thing. So I think the stories were fun. I'm not sure I would have used as many or used the ones necessarily that he used, but he's definitely a good storyteller and they are entertaining. And as you mentioned at the end, he's got the, you know, the breakdown of all the different biographies that he shared. Temple Grandin was someone in particular that like I was familiar with, but didn't have a lot of the details that he shared, and thought that was really, really kind of cool to kind of fill in a lot of those gaps. So I think I would recommend people read this one. I definitely liked it better than 48 Laws of Power.
Okay.
I feel like if you've got to pick one Robert Greene book that you should read, this would be the one. Now, I know he's probably got others that I haven't read, but 48 Laws of Power is kind of the one that is probably the most popular. And then there's one about the laws of seduction that I have absolutely no interest in. But this was kind of best case scenario for me when I heard you say you wanted to read a Robert Greene book. I was bracing myself, but I actually enjoyed this one.
Well, and I'll tell you that even though I gave it a 3-star rating, I would still recommend people read it. The thing is, I just want them to go in knowing like, hey, you know, like there's good stuff in there. It's just a little bit longer than it needs to be, and that might drop your expectations a little bit. So
yeah, that is fair. I should caveat that recommendation that people read this is like, if you're going to pick this up to read it, you got to know what you're in for.
Yeah.
This is a very long book. And I don't think I probably would have picked this one up to read it without having to do it for the podcast. But having said that, I'm glad that I put in the effort and got through it.
Good. All right, so let's put Mastery on the shelf, and then Mike, you get to pick our next book.
All right, so the next book that we are going to do is Super Communicators by Charles Duhigg, and this is hopefully going to be a bit of a redemption for me with Charles Duhigg. I was not a fan of The Power of Habit. Or he had one after that too, which was like the big productivity book, productivity in air quotes, because it was like smarter, faster, better. And it felt very much like the pseudo productivity that Cal Newport talked about in Slow Productivity.
It's also a Daft Punk song, but you know, what are you going to do?
Yeah. But I like the idea of super communicators and just communicating better, more effectively. You know, having had the day job previous to this, I have a greater appreciation for the importance of communication in day-to-day work. So I feel like this is an important topic and haven't really seen a whole lot of books about this. Was kind of surprised to see Charles Duhigg write one, but hey, let's read it together. And after that?
So after that, I stole a book from Mike, and this book is called Why We Sleep by Matt Walker. And let me give you a little bit of a reason why I stole this book from Mike. So I want to request book recommendations from the audience. And it's going to take a minute for us to get the pipes all connected in the background. That way we have a very easy, seamless way for you to do that. But look for that coming up in the next episode. We'll describe how to give us recommendations in terms of I would like to do an audience book, and Mike would as well. We'd like to do an audience book for not my next one, but that I think it'll be my next one. And what we'll tell you is that we're going to enable lots of feedback into that process, but Mike and I still get to pick the book, right? We're not just going to let you all just pick based on like number of votes or number of recommendations. We still get we'll winnow it down to, you know, three or whatever. And then Mike and I will pick from the top three or whatever that might be. So Mike, do you have any gap books right now? Are you reading anything on the side?
I do. So mentioned in the show that Ryan Holiday kind of served as the assistant to Robert Greene, it sounds like, for this book. Well, I discovered a book written by Ryan Holiday's assistant called Ghost Town Living by Brent Underwood. Now, have you seen, there's a handful of people who are online that kind of went in together and bought this ghost town called Cerro Gordo?
No, not at all.
It's like Nathan Barry was one of them, and I forget the couple other like recognizable names. They went in together and they bought this ghost town. So this is that group, and Brent Underwood, my understanding is like he was part of that group and he actually lived there for a while. So I saw some of the stuff that they were sharing, you know, like when they bought it. And I just think the whole concept of the ghost town is fascinating. You know, you have this whole town that existed and then like it just disappears. Like how many stories are in those places that are completely abandoned? Like that kind of stuff is fascinating to me. So This looks like an interesting read, and I'm going to try to get through this one before Super Communicators.
Wonderful. My gap book is the same as it was last time, because Mastery was so long and I didn't have enough time to focus to that one as well. But this one's Evergood Endeavor by Tim Keller, and it's part of a grant project that I'm working on right now. But it's really good so far. I'm really enjoying it. Just need to get a little more time in there and crack at it a little bit more.
Awesome.
So that wraps up another episode of Bookworm. We want to thank you guys. Thank you all for listening. If you would like to see the episodes or find the episodes, you can go to bookworm.fm online. And if you're interested in the pro show or the bootleg feed, go to our Patreon page. So patreon.com/bookwormfm. Check that out. And we'd really appreciate it if you became a member. So other than that, Mike, thanks for another great conversation.
Absolutely. And if you are reading along with us, pick up Super Communicators by Charles Duhigg, and we will talk to you in a couple of weeks.